Thanks, Ian. And I'd like to thank the Paul Woolley Centre for inviting me back to speak to this conference after last year. I'm particularly grateful to have the opportunity to do so in a session chaired by Ian McFarlane. Ian was instrumental in setting the tone for the way we at the bank think about financial stability policy today. His example helped us take the historical insights of authors like Charles Kindleberger and transform them into a practical approach to analysis. Now, the financial crisis has spurred a huge, multifaceted regulatory response. I know Jim Murphy's going to talk about some of the reforms that have actually happened or are in train. So what I'd like to do today is talk about just one element of that response, the calls for a so-called macroprudential policy framework. Development of such a framework is at a rather early stage, but it's attracting a lot of attention and energy. For example, following their meeting in Seoul in late 2010, the G20 leaders called on international agencies to do more work on the subject, which they have done. But what is a macroprudential policy framework? Is it separate from financial stability policy? Does Australia even need a whole new framework? So as background to the IMF's recent Financial Sector Assessment Program Review of Australia, or FSAP, APRA and the bank prepared a paper on how we think about financial stability policy and its macroprudential dimension. In essence, we see macroprudential policy as something that is subsumed within the broader policy framework for promoting financial stability. That seems to be something of a minority view internationally. So we published the paper last month after the IMF visits had concluded to put our take on this subject into the public domain. So what I'd like to do today is give a little more detail about our thinking on the issue of the macroprudential framework as set out in that joint paper. After giving a brief history of the term macroprudential, I'll organise my remarks around three assertions which are consciously intended to be a little more sceptical about the idea that a whole new framework is needed than some of the international commentary has been. And in doing so, I hope to provide a bit more clarity about the international policy debate. Now, first, macroprudential policy is only a subset of the policies intended to enhance financial stability. For a start, it's not really designed for managing crises when they do occur. And I would argue it does no good to muddy the waters by claiming things as macroprudential when they're not, just for the sake of it. My second assertion is that most supposedly macroprudential policy tools are, in fact, the usual prudential tools long used by ostensibly microprudential supervisors. What is new is the motivation behind their use. And even that is not particularly new in many countries, including Australia. And third, the build-up to the recent crisis resulted more from a microprudential failure than a macroprudential one. The easing in US mortgage lending standards, the growing reliance on short-term wholesale funding, the low risk weights applied to complex and highly leveraged structured securities were all things that an avowedly microprudential supervisor could have, and arguably should have, noticed and responded to. Now, certainly a more holistic or system-wide perspective could help supervisors see if risks are building up. This could happen because many individual institutions are doing the same risky things. Or it could happen because particular risks have been concentrated in a few institutions. But that macro perspective does not necessarily require a whole new institutional or policy framework for regulation. It possibly might not even require new policy tools. I would argue that macroprudential policy is indeed more of a state of mind than a suite of tools. I think it would be a mistake if a focus on macroprudential frameworks were to occur at the expense of much-needed reforms to normal prudential policy arrangements, both at the international level and in some of the jurisdictions overseas where the crisis began. It would also be a pity if a false dichotomy between macroprudential and microprudential supervision were to be drawn. The two perspectives do not need to be pitted against each other. They can both be parts of one holistic view of financial regulation and supervision, which is how we see it in Australia. So what is macroprudential policy? Turns out that the term macroprudential first appeared in internal documents of the precursor to the Basel Committee as early as the late 1970s. The BIS and others started using it publicly by the mid-1980s. It isn't a new term. Neither are the concerns behind it. The underlying idea was that prudential supervisors should take a system-wide view in the way they supervise. They should recognise that the actions of individual firms can collectively generate systemic risk, even if those actions are individually rational. They should recognise that risk can build up over time and that the distribution of risk can matter. And according to this view, they should avoid focusing narrowly on the safety of individual institutions without regard to the feedback from those institutions' behaviour to the wider system. So the original idea behind macroprudential policy was a sensible one. It was about how prudential supervisors should do their job and the perspectives that they should have. The policy tools are the tools of prudential regulation and supervision. I would go as far to say that what others think of as macroprudential supervision, the Australian authorities consider simply to be competent supervision. Now, not every policy that helps financial stability can be reasonably labelled macroprudential. It would be needlessly confusing to shovel everything into that category. Why not just call it financial stability policy after all? For example, central banks' provision of liquidity to the market is as old as central banking itself. It's clearly helpful for financial stability, both before and during a crisis. But is it macroprudential? I have actually heard some people claim that, but I don't see it that way. We should also remember that not every policy that helps financial stability was necessarily enacted with that purpose in mind. Sometimes policies are worthwhile for completely different reasons, but happen to be helpful for financial stability as well. A good example of this is consumer protection regulation around the provision of credit. Consumers generally have less information and expertise in financial matters than the firms that lend to them. Regulators try to redress this imbalance in regulation. For example, they might specify what lenders must tell consumers about the loans they offer, or impose more general requirements that the loan product must be suitable for the borrower. This is seen as worthwhile because it prevents possibly vulnerable people from being ripped off or simply from unwittingly making a decision that is not in their interests. A well-designed consumer protection regime can be very useful for financial stability, even though that is not its primary intention. Australia's National Consumer Credit Code, and indeed the Uniform Consumer Credit Code that preceded it, requires that the lender must be able to show that the consumer can be reasonably expected to repay the loan from their own resources without having to sell the collateral. If not, the loan can be modified or even set aside by the courts. Lenders then have incentives to extend credit responsibly. They should especially want to avoid the asset-based lending and ninja loans that caused so many problems in the United States in the lead-up to the crisis. It's no surprise that the US regulation in this sphere was not uniform, and it did not cover all consumer borrowers. Now, as I mentioned before, the original idea behind macroprudential policy is that, in essence, it is prudential policy. Many of the so-called macroprudential tools currently being discussed in international forums are the usual tools available to a prudential supervisor. Liquidity rules, risk weights, capital standards, large exposure limits, and all of those things. They might be calibrated differently, and the reasons motivating their use might differ. It is in this sense that macroprudential policy seems new. But in most cases, they're the same old policy tools, just as the original proponents at the BIS intended. Part of the confusion in recent international discussions seems to lie in how some observers think prudential supervisors operate. It's become common for some people overseas to refer to bank supervisors, like APRA, as microprudential regulators. A quite distorted view of how supervisors do their work has arisen, and it's one that I consider quite unhelpful. The misconception that supervisors charged with ensuring the safety and soundness of banks, this misconception's arisen that they're thought incapable of looking beyond the individual banks they supervise. It is such a caricature of prudential supervisors that the best way I can think of to explain why it's a misconception is to show you a cartoon. The view of some observers seems to be that a microprudential supervisor is like this self-satisfied looking fellow, complete with a capital adequacy report on his desk. And he's saying, the bank I supervise is well capitalised, and that's all I need to care about. Well, it might well be that there are supervisors who think in this narrow way. But I labelled this cartoon as the microprudential nutter, because it reminds me so much of the concept popularised by Sir Mervyn King. He made the point that even if a monetary policymaker cared only about inflation, an inflation nutter, as he put it, monetary policy would still respond to output, because output tells you something about future inflation. Likewise, any sensible prudential supervisor knows that the number one cause of bank death is a systemic crisis, and that the safety of the bank they supervise depends on the environment around it. Even a microprudential nutter would look at the big picture. So I think a better cartoon version of a good prudential supervisor looks something like figure two. This is this picture. And here he is, he's looking out the window to the broader environment and he's saying, a systemic crisis could harm the bank I supervise, so I should watch for signs of one and respond as appropriate. And it's in this sense that I would argue that macroprudential policy is really about the state of mind and not the suite of tools. The tools are already there. It's in how they're meant to be employed that the differences between micro and macro arise. In fact, I would dispute that there's much different in macroprudential policy from supervision as it's currently practiced in many countries. It's a bit like that old joke about the writer who discovered that, you know, after all these decades they'd been writing prose. I think a lot of the bank supervisors are discovering that they really are a macroprudential and they have been all along. For this reason, I would caution against efforts to invent too many new and untried tools, particularly ones designed to be manipulated over the cycle, much like monetary policy. One such tool we've been hearing about from other jurisdictions lately is to set a cap on loan-to-valuation ratios, or LVRs, for mortgages, and then vary that cap from time to time. Now, obviously, it's prudent to have some sort of limit to the leverage in collateralised loans like mortgages. The alternative would be the situation we saw in the United Kingdom and the Netherlands, where prior to the crisis, you could borrow up to as much as 125% of valuation. And more importantly, where a lot of people actually did so, not just a small fringe. And I don't think that's good practice. People need to provide some deposit when they buy a home. It protects them if something were to go wrong for them, like a job loss or illness, and especially if that were to happen at the same time that housing prices are falling. The question is whether policymakers should go further and set maximum ratios well below 100% and whether that maximum should be varied periodically. Now, this might be sensible for the jurisdictions that have adopted that policy. For some of them, their exchange rate regimes constrain them from raising interest rates instead. But that's not relevant in Australia. I also have a number of conceptual reservations about an LVR cap, and those lead to me to question whether this kind of product regulation is a sensible prudential tool in the Australian environment. The first issue is that this kind of policy is only relevant for home mortgages. Business lending can be more easily structured around such a restriction, especially the property development loans, which are especially risky, as we've seen in Spain and Ireland and many other places over recent years. And for unsecured lending, it's not even relevant. In any case, high LVR loans are still available to at least some borrowers in the jurisdictions that set this cap. In Hong Kong, for example, the excess over the cap's covered by the government-sponsored mortgage insurer. And frankly, this is not so different from Australia's prudential framework, which requires higher risk weights on high LVR loans, especially those that are not insured. The second issue is that the cap would have to be set very low to be binding on existing home buyers who are trading up. First home buyers would be squeezed out. but most buyers would be little affected. Third, the cap would not prevent boom-bust cycles in housing prices. The evidence from overseas is that it instead limits the increase in arrears rate that occurs when the bust comes. That's because the borrowers who get into difficulty on their repayments are more likely to be able to have some equity and therefore be able to sell rather than default when prices fall. Now, that's not a bad thing, but in the end, our responsibility for financial stability is about protecting the real economy. Protecting the banks from the real economy is not the ultimate goal. I also worry that focusing too much on the LVR would be a mistake. Lenders that do that are engaged in asset-based lending, which is exactly the kind of practice we want to avoid. There are many other dimensions to lending standards beyond LVRs. In my view, the borrower's ability to repay is more important than the collateral. And I noticed that John Laker actually made similar comments. APRA is looking very much at serviceability rather than LVRs in their analysis of lending practices in the Australian environment. Lenders also need to think about how certain they are about the valuation in that loan-to-valuation ratio. One of the things that went wrong in the United States during the boom was that the valuations behind the lending decisions were often flawed or even completely fraudulent. Now, as with many other reforms that have been proposed since the crisis, new macroprudential policy frameworks are being advocated with the view that these might help prevent similar crises in future. Well, would they? Well, maybe. I'm not convinced that they would be the most effective approach. If we think about what actually went wrong in the United States in the lead up to the crisis, it was in essence that a lot of bad assets were created, in this case mortgages and the securities based on them, and that these bad assets were distributed around the global financial system, primarily to entities that were funding themselves at very short terms. Well, how is this possible? Obviously, there were lapses in risk management and governance at the banks and other firms involved. In part, though, it was a failure of prudential supervision that enabled those lapses. Many of the lenders weren't supervised at all. Of those that were, many nonetheless were not stopped from making loans of dubious quality. That was a microprudential problem. There was a macro-level element to the boom. Those poor-quality loans were packaged up and distributed around the world. Each national supervisor thought that it was a good idea to transfer the risk out of their system to someone else. It could then be spread around the world, supposedly more thinly, although what actually happened is everyone just created more risk. And that showed a lack of macro perspective. But it was also a microprudential failure because banks were allowed to buy those securities without holding enough capital to cover their risk. Risk capture, getting the risk weights at least broadly right, is very much a micro-level aspect of prudential regulation and always has been. Macroprudential frameworks would not have solved this problem. Nor was a macroprudential institutional framework strictly necessary to avoid the liquidity problems brought about by short-term funding of these security holdings. Funding and liquidity are traditional micro or institutional level concerns of prudential supervisors. It certainly needed more attention globally in the lead up to the crisis, but this didn't require a whole new macroprudential or systemic risk regulator. It just needed more attention from the supervisors and the Basel Committee. So where does that leave financial stability policymakers? If all the tools are in the hands of the prudential supervisor, which in Australia is APRA, what role does the non-supervisory central bank have in financial stability policy? Well, there are many things we can do, which we described in the joint RBA-APRA paper we released last month. Crisis management's one aspect. Liquidity provision is another. And there's also the one use of the word macroprudential that I actually feel comfortable about, which is macroprudential analysis. This involves identifying the risks in the financial system that ostensibly microprudential regulators can respond to. It doesn't mean looking at only at macro-level data, by the way. It's usually the riskiest banks or borrowers that cause the trouble, not the average ones, so you have to look at the distribution. So I can probably best explain how this works with, yes, you guessed it, another cartoon. I'd like you to imagine that the supervisor from the previous cartoon, and I call him Mike Rowe, receives a visit from the head of the central bank's financial stability department, Prudential, sometimes nicknamed Macro Prue. Now, Prue has news for Mike. All the banks are doing crazy lending. Systemic risk is rising. And Mike responds, "Gosh, thanks, Macro Prue. I'll raise their Pillar 2 capital add-ons right away." Of course, it's just a cartoon, and there are several things wrong with it. The first of which is quite obvious. You would never catch me in a little black dress and a whole string of pearls. And that hair. No, not my look. But on a more serious side, if lending standards were imprudent, Mike would already know about it. He would be seeing it in his own supervisory observations. I'd also point out that Pillar 2 capital add-ons are not the only tools at his disposal. That said, I'd like to draw out a few points from this picture. The first is the focus on lending standards. Risk-taking, here in the form of easier lending standards, is what we're watching for. It's about behaviour and not just a single number. The second is that a qualitative assessment might well be good enough. Prue isn't telling Mike that her favoured measure of systemic risk has risen to such and such a level and that this has breached some particular trigger point. Existing models of systemic risk simply aren't good enough to be relied upon that way. And they probably never will be, given that systemic risk is unobservable. But informed judgment is probably good enough in most cases. The third point to note is that Mike already has the tools at his disposal to respond. Prudential supervisors have always had the scope to increase banks' minimum capital ratios above the Basel minimum. That's what the Pillar 2 of the Basel framework is for. Not every supervisor used that power, but it was there. The fourth and final point about this picture is that Mike believes Prue and is willing to act on it. And this is pretty much how it works in Australia. It comes down to the relationship between the agencies and the culture of the supervisor to create that willingness. There doesn't need to be a so-called systemic risk regulator issuing public warnings or directions, telling the supervisor what to do. Some jurisdictions might want to set things up that way because of their particular arrangements, but there are other ways that might be better here. In Australia, we think that a culture of cooperation, dialogue and mutual respect is more important than formalised arrangements. The Council of Financial Regulators has proved itself to be a low-cost and flexible way of coordinating between the agencies alongside the bilateral relationships. We think we have the essential elements needed to promote financial stability with a holistic frame of mind. In the end, what is needed is the wisdom to see the problems and the willingness to act in response. And no elaborate set of institutional arrangements and rules can manufacture those two things. Thank you very much for your time.
Can I exercise the chairman's prerogative and ask you a question? I'm a little bit out of touch with terminology, but could you comment on that aspect of Basel III whereby someone, some institution, can levy an additional capital charge if aggregate credit growth exceeds some threshold?
Yes. Okay, so Ian's just asked me to comment on the countercyclical capital buffer in Basel III. And so the idea is that the supervisor, which in this case would be APRA, would have the scope to add on capital requirements in the form of extending the conservation buffer at times when systemic risk is rising. Now, it is true that in the Basel papers, they talked about one particular guide that you could use, which is a particular detrending of the ratio of credit to GDP. And the interesting thing is the original idea for this particular detrending came out of a paper that Phil Lowe wrote when he was at the BIS. However, that sort of useful data summarisation technique very nearly got built into the Basel rules as a rule. And fortunately, saner minds prevailed and it's just been built in as a guide. Because, I mean, certainly our analysis, and we go through this quite a bit in the joint RBA APRA paper, there's a box about the countercyclical capital buffer. But we just don't think it makes sense to take this one particular detrending of the credit to GDP ratio and say that is systemic risk. It's just intended to be a starting point. And in some sense, you'll look at everything. You'll look at all the things that we at the Reserve Bank look at when we're putting together the Financial Stability Review. You'll look at all the things that APRA look at, including things like the risk appetite and behaviours of the supervised entities. And you'll use that to form a judgment to decide if it's time to actually add in a bit more capital. There are certainly people who think that this should have been some kind of rule, and quite frankly, you know, the Boreo rule will be, you know, the idea that launched yet another 1,000 academic papers in the same way that the Taylor rule did for monetary policy, but I don't, just as no central bank actually rigidly follows a Taylor rule, no sensible prudential supervisor would be following a Hodrick-Prescott-filtered, one-sided Hodrick-Prescott-filtered detrended credit to GDP ratio as the decision variable to decide when to put this buffer on.
Enjoyed your talk very much. Can I put two propositions to you that while the economic theory of individual risk-taking has been developing very well in recent years, the systemic effects have been very badly neglected. And one of the reasons for that is that there's an implicit assumption of normal distribution ruling in financial markets, whereas fat tails are much more likely to be common than was thought. And there's a whole literature of chaotic behaviour when fat tails rule. And I wonder if the Reserve Bank might like to take that up as a research project.
Well, I'm actually a great believer in thinking beyond the sort of the DSGE framework of... So the question was about whether fat tails in distributions is one of the reasons why there haven't been good models of systemic risk.
There's a whole
huge literature, and I would agree with that. And in fact, over a decade ago, I've been writing papers that use power laws to explain certain phenomenon in, for example, the consequences of economic geography for measures of debt and housing prices. So I think you will find in central banks a fair bit of sympathy for looking at new models, or not so much new models, but just looking at the whole literature. I mean, it's certainly not true that central banks were narrowly focused on that sort of DSGE framework. Models should be dynamic and stochastic, and they should have, they should add up properly. So in some sense, general equilibrium. But where that particular literature got to was quite narrow and was quite ill-suited. And it wasn't really the rationality that was the issue. The normality was part of the story, but it was also that you had representative agents. And I think the thing that we really feel in the Reserve Bank is, this distribution of risk is really important. So if you think about a DSGE, it's not the rationality that's the issue. It's that you've got a representative agent who is infinitely lived and who is, got full information about the model. So in other words, in layman's terms, you're the only person in the world, you're going to live forever, and you know everything. Anyone who's got teenagers will recognise this, and we agree that we've got to grow up out of this adolescent model of economics. Thank you for providing me with the opportunity to put that joke in public. We actually are looking at this quite extensively. I think there's a lot of really interesting work by a number of people on, particularly power laws and fat tails. I think there's some quite useful work there, and you'll be hearing more, and sort of looking at networks and so on. And there's a number of central banks working on this, so you'll be hearing more about this in future.
You talked about LVRs as a way to potentially stabilise spending behaviour. Australia's had recourse for a long time. Does that give you a lot of comfort, relative to the US, with people just having the same fees spent?
Okay, so the question was, I talked about LVRs as a way of potentially putting a cap on easing and lending standards, and does the alternative of having full recourse on loans make me feel better about Australia versus the US? I think I made the point in the speech that if I was picking a dimension of lending standards to put more attention on, it's probably not the LVR overall, it's things like serviceability. I think how much you actually lend somebody and whether they can actually make the repayments is far more important than how much you get back at the end. And in some sense, focusing on the LVR is exactly what lenders in the US were doing, because they were saying, well, it doesn't matter if they can't repay the loan because I can get the property back quickly. It's worth pointing out that depending on how you count it, only either 6 or 11 states in the US actually have non-recourse lending, but more than half of them have non-judicial foreclosure, which means the lender can get the property quickly, but then they have to go to court for the difference. So even though legally it's recourse lending, the lenders act as if it's non-recourse. This is an important distinction, and it wasn't so much about the laws and households throwing in the keys. I was watching this. I was doing a lot of work on this when I was at the Biz in 2007, 2008, and there was remarkably little evidence of people handing in the keys because they just decided, well, I'm underwater on my mortgage, I can afford the repayment, but I choose not to. You did not see that in the first few years. You saw two things going on. One was people who'd been given a loan they had no hope of affording, either ever or just something bad happened to them, so that it was a genuine capacity to repay problem. And the others were just fraudulent. There were an awful lot of straw buyers and people who lied at all ends, you know, the whole end of the chain. So in that respect, it wasn't really about, particularly in the early stage, it was not about people handing in the keys just because they were underwater. You have to remember that, I mean, when things started going bad and arrears rates really started rising, housing prices had only fallen a few percent, and in some cities a bit more, but the 30% fall that we've now seen didn't happen for quite a number of years. The arrears rates that started hurting didn't require a very large fall in housing prices. So this was really about a different dynamic. But I think it did change the ability to get the property quickly, at least before the courts became clogged, and there were so many foreclosures, that just changed the incentives of the lenders. And I think that's a really... It's an underappreciated element of what went wrong in the US.
I'd like to dispute your facts about whether APRA looks at macroeconomic information in their work. You can go through the whole website and look at the research papers. There was never any mention of any awareness of any systemic risk arising from macroeconomic factors from APRA. Now, if you doubt what I said, right? I happen to have been in the research, heading the research for 5 years, over from 2005 to about 2009. Over that period, there was never any discussion of macroeconomic threats. And neither did RBA, by the way, because every quarter we see reviews about the macroeconomy in the quarterly reviews. And there they saw debt rising, but they said, well, there's no problem because assets also rising. And so the net asset values of households are fine.
Okay,
that was what I saw. So okay. I dispute the fact that you say that APRA takes into macro-prudential factors already, implicitly.
Well, that may have been your experience. So the question was disputing whether, in fact, APRA had a macro perspective. And, you know, John Trowbridge was, you know, a member there, and he'll be speaking later, and perhaps he can address that question as well. But I think I have a rather different interpretation of what both the bank and APRA were doing at the time. And if you look at the quarterly report, the statement on monetary policy, that's really about what's going on. And if you look at the contemporaneous financial stability reviews, I think you will find, particularly in the overviews of that, the messages were very clear. The messages were very clear that risk appetite had gone up, credit spreads were very low, the price of risk had gotten very low, and it was not a good look. I would also refer to you to, I think it's the 2005 or 2006 annual report of APRA, particularly the chairman's forward, where they made exactly the same point, that people had been lulled into a false sense of security by these low risk spreads, risk appetite was very low, and people had to prepare themselves for the possibility that might reverse. So I think a more holistic view of all of the communication that both agencies were doing would give you a rather different perspective. And I think the other thing is, I can tell you how things have been since 2008 when I became head of financial stability. And there is an industry... Actually, I commend to you the paper that we put out last month with APRA, because it actually goes through what they've got with the industry analysis team and how that all works. And it may well be that the research department was focusing on non-macro topics because that was the comparative advantage of that team, whereas the Reserve Bank was doing more macro topics. But I think you'll find that the cross-pollination and the sharing of views between APRA and the RBA, I mean, I go there every year, and my deputy goes there after every FSR. We present our view of the macro situation to the frontline supervision. We describe all of these measures that we have built into the system in that paper, and I commend that to you, because I think it's true that individual staff within APRA may well have a sort of less macro perspective, but it's just not my experience. There is a lot of understanding that the macro environment impinges upon the decisions that need to be made by supervisors in the way that they supervise. So now it may well be that hasn't been completely throughout the entire organisation, but I think you know, in my dealings with particularly the senior people, I think that that attitude is very much there. And I think it would be a good idea to have a look at the paper that we've recently put out. Thanks.
Well, 2008 is after the fact. I think by 2008, it's all over.
Well, and as I said, 2005 and 2006, you need to look at things like those other reports, as I mentioned.